Two Dimension Comics, Episode 7. Hey folks, welcome to Two Dimension Comic Book Podcast, the podcast with no direction. I'm your host, Dallas Busha, and today with me we have...
Al.
And Don.
All right. Yeah, we have three of the crew. I'm really excited. We almost had four. We're actually waiting on the Rook, so he might still show up later tonight. So don't hold your breath on that, though. So this is going to be a really fun episode, I think. One of the main topics we're going to start covering is comic book writers. Now, that's something that Don, Rook, and I talked about in the past, I think on episodes 2 and 3. Well, Al never got his fair say. So we're going to give him an opportunity today, and then we're going to kind of jump off that. How's that sound?
Sounds good.
All right. Well, then without further ado, Al, what do you think? What are some of your favorite writers?
Well, I have to say that I started out, the first comic I read was a Fantastic Four, number 57. Yeah, I know that was a long time ago.
Good Lord.
I guess Stan and Jack, you know? I mean, Jack wrote the plots and... Stan did too, so those are probably my two favorite writers. All those issues from like number 1 to like 106 or whatever.
102.
I mean, yeah, great stories, concepts, art, you know, yeah, that's my favorite. From that same era, from the 60s, Arnold Drake, who created the Doom Patrol, created Dead Man, did all the Jerry Lewis and Bob Hope and Dobie Gillis comics. Great writer, real offbeat, real, you know, and of course, like Don said before, it's always the artist too, you know. I mean, and Bob Ochsner, the artist on those, one of my favorite all-time humor artists, good girl artist. Yeah, definitely.
So now, Arnold Drake, was he pretty big at the time? During that era, was he well-known, or was it kind of after the fact that he became popular, kind of like a lot of those Archie artists?
Well, I think he was well-known in the fact that you could, for a while there, I think in all the issues of the Doom Patrol, you could see his name, but he never became like a big, you know, like Stan Lee was obviously the big guy, you know, because he was promoting himself constantly, you know, Roy
yeah.
Thomas and
yeah.
stuff like that. Most of the DC guys, you know, they did the work and, you know, and that was it, you know. But the lasting effect on some of those, and also did Challenger of the Unknown, too. The lasting effect is, like, when I go and reread them, I still get a lot of enjoyment out of them and go, like, wow, these are really quirky and cool, you know. So, I mean, definitely him. And if you go back further, like in the 50s, it would be, you know, the guy, the EC guys. There you go, another EC reference.
Hey, that's the obligatory reference for this episode.
Oh, and there'll be another one later too. But anyway, yeah, Al Feldstein, who did all the horror books, and then Harvey Kurtzman, who did sci-fi and the war comics. You know, I mean, awesome stuff. You know, going back before that, you know, Will Eisner.
Oh yeah,
you know,
you can't.
We talked about him before, you know.
You can't not mention him, which is funny because last episode when we were talking about him, it was for one of my favorite artists, and it's neat that coming ahead of this episode, he's one of your favorite writers because he was. I mean, his art and writing were kind of inseparable. He was, you know, a writer artist. That's what he did. He was a creator, and
yeah.
it was nice to see that his stories were just as strong as his art.
Yeah, very much so. I guess going into the 70s, I was really into the Swamp Thing. You know, Len Wein.
Yeah, Len Wein.
Oh, yeah.
With Bernie Wrights, and that was one of my favorites. And then Marv Wolfman and Gene Colan and Tomb of Dracula. I mean, another pretty great series of stories, you know. And then, of course, in the 80s, you get Alan Moore, and you know, who's like, you know, one of the big boy, one of the all-time guys or whatever, you know, and he was obviously, what was he, the Swamp Thing was the first thing he did for DC, I think it was.
Bernie Wrightson, probably.
But then,
he was doing House of Secrets. I know he was doing some of the stories, but he was still fairly new when they did Swamp Thing.
Right, right. But before that, he was doing Marvel Man, right, for British publications.
Bernie Wrightson?
No, Alan Moore. Wasn't he writing Marvel Man before Swamp Thing?
Yes.
Or Captain Britain. Yeah. Captain Britain. It was. It was. Like
he did all those. He did Captain Britain, Marvel Man, V for Vendetta. He was doing all that stuff for
Warrior, before, right? 2008 Warrior. Warrior, one of those books.
It
that's
was
it.
Warrior.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Well,
so.
But he also did DR and Quench for 2000 AD.
And the Ballad of Halo Jones. I think that might have been 2000 AD also.
Yeah. Yeah, he did that before he came over to DC as well.
Well, it's nice.
Going back again. Going back, well, I'm not done. I gotta put Archie Goodwin in here, because he, of course, creepy and eerie back in the '60s. You know,
ding ding.
Some of the greatest EC type stories ever. You know, Archie Goodwin, and I'm sure I'm missing somebody, but you know, I mean, those guys were my favorites.
That's awesome.
You know, one thing. Talking about Archie Goodwin, I wanted to bring him up on mine, but I thought I just can't put everybody in the planet on it. Archie Goodwin, I always knew more as an editor. You know, he was always a mainstay of Marvel. But there was a couple of times where he really threw me, and I started realizing it was how he put the stories together. The first one, George Perez did a miniseries of Logan's Run, you know, the movie adaptation, which is quite nice. Now, I bought the second issue and worked my way up, and David Michelinie, I think, was the writer of it. And after I finished the series, I found the first issue, and Archie Goodwin wrote that, you know, with George Perez drawing it. And I remember I picked it up at some grocery store in the back of a pile, and I read the story, and it's just how he put it together and how the story ended, you know, where his life clock is flashing. And it just, I thought, man, this is the best thing I ever read. You know, the other ones were as good, but it's just how the story was assembled kind of caught me. And then later, when I, in the early 80s, DC republished Walt Simonson and Archie Goodwin's Manhunter, and I bought it because Walt Simonson drew it. But just the way the story, again, how it was put together, how the story starts out, and how as the story progressed, you started finding out how it started out all through it. It was how he arranged the story and composed it. I've never heard anybody like that. And he was always one of my favorites as far as, again, how he assembled a story.
Definitely.
I've never heard of that one. Manhunter?
Yeah, it was, Al, you tell us about it.
Manhunter was back in Detective Comics back in the 70s. Yeah. And it was a backup strip. And it was the first time Walt Simonson's work, you know, was, I had ever seen it. And it was just like, it blew me away, you know, design element on it or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, and was he a redo of an older character, or no?
I want to say it was, because I think Jack Kirby did an old thing of Manhunter. I know Jack Kirby did one of those first issue specials in the late 70s of Manhunter. So I don't know if they intended it to be. But this is when Marshall Rogers was doing
Batman.
Yeah, Batman for Detective Comics. What was the writer's name?
Was it Englehart?
Yeah, Steve Englehart. And, but that was just an 8-issue story in the back of it. And I don't know how many stories they did, but the final issue of Manhunter, it was the full story. It was Batman and Manhunter together, and it was the full issue. And it finished.
Excellent stuff, really. And, of course, Dallas, you're being a Star Wars fan. Archie Goodwin did a lot of the strips.
Yeah, I was. I kind of wanted to interject to say that Don said he knew Archie Goodwin mostly as an editor. I actually was introduced to Archie Goodwin through the adaptations of the old Star Wars films, at least the first one. I had, back when I was very young, I remember my mom bought me one of the huge oversized Marvel editions of Star Wars, and it was, you know, the adaptation of the first film. And sure enough, Archie Goodwin's name was on that, and so I only knew him as a guy that adapted film at the time.
Right. Mm-hmm. Did Archie Goodwin do the adaptation of Flash Gordon that Al Williamson drew back in the 80s?
I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised, but I wasn't sure. I never read it.
Great. Williamson drew it.
Yeah, that
so
sounds about right.
Awesome. Oh, yeah. I've got it somewhere in the vault here.
Well,
or whatever.
He was the one that also created the Epic Illustrated magazine for Marvel.
Yeah. That's
and
right.
The whole Epic
That's
Comics right. line, which is, you know, I love those.
He was a great guy, and I think he was really well respected in the industry, and especially in the Marvel offices, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure.
He influenced a lot of people, gave people always good, solid advice. And, yeah, that's all you ever hear is what a nice guy he was. I mean, he was always professional.
Which is nice compared to, like, say, Jim Shooter, who it seems polarizing. Some people love him, some people hate him.
Yeah, yeah. But you never hear that about Archie Goodwin. But it's always funny because that's, again, I always hear about him as an editor and, you know, how he put these things together and how he influenced people. And I think that kind of eclipses his writing. But those two examples I gave to you, I read the story, again, because of the artist. And then when I finished, I'm like, God, who wrote this? You know, and it was always Archie Goodwin.
Nice.
You know who was an offbeat writer, too, back in the day? I don't know if he's well-respected or not, at least not by some magazines, but I kind of like the Spectre stories that Michael Fleischer did.
Yeah, I did. I love those.
Oh, yeah.
Those are crazy stories, yeah, and the Jonah Hex. He was a Jonah Hex creator or writer, too, you know. Those are pretty wild, some of those, you know.
You know, it was...
Especially...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. Especially the last issue where you find out what exactly happens to Jonah Hex. That was really crazy. Did you ever read that one?
No, I'd seen a couple of them when I was a kid, but I never read all of them.
I'm not going to tell you what it was, but he ends up in a wax museum. Let's leave it that way.
You know, a funny thing about Jonah Hex, now I've read some of the books here and there, but it's mostly the modern stuff. I mean, they have a newer edition of Jonah Hex that DC releases, but I was just talking to a friend of mine earlier, and he's not a comic book fan, but he happened to see the Jonah Hex movie. He really enjoyed it, and he really liked the character, and I thought that was interesting, because I always wondered how good that film did, because I heard, you know, budget-wise, financially, it didn't do very well, and I always wondered, you know, what kind of feedback non-comic book readers would take from that.
I hadn't seen it either.
I've never saw it. I've heard people talk about it on some other podcast. I think people were excited about it, but I don't think they cared much for it when it's finished.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know anything about it?
No.
Did you see it?
Well, that's the thing. I've never seen it either, and one of the main reasons is because I heard so much negative feedback on it. And I don't like to let something like that influence my viewing, but that just made me not go out of my way to see it. And it just didn't seem that interesting to me. So, you know, I enjoyed the comic, but I never saw the movie. But it was just neat hearing people that don't read comics actually enjoying that film. So it gives us hope.
Yeah, well, I mean, it wasn't the most well-known character in the DC universe, you know, but it is a cool one, so, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he was always a Western character, but after Crisis and Infinite Earths, I know DC was published, and I guess he was more like a Blade Runner or Buckaroo Banzai type character. He was in the future.
Rocket Raccoon.
Oh, that's right. Mark Teixeira did, though.
It was that. Yeah. I never read him. I just remember seeing it, and I guess they put him back in the Wild West again.
That's right.
It's funny.
Go ahead, Al.
Al said Mark Teixeira, and that's funny. I've never seen that work, but I can see Mark Teixeira's style really lending itself to a character like Jonah Hex.
Yeah, well, his Ghost Rider was pretty, you know, good, mm-hmm. So Jonah Hex would... Yeah, but that's right. Jonah Hex was wearing like a black suit, and he was like, had the guns, but he was in the future. I have to dig those out. Yeah, I remember those. I read them a long time ago.
I never read them. I just remember seeing them in the stands and seeing advertisements for it. And I don't know when they dropped that and brought him back to the Wild West again.
I did get that graphic novel, which was okay, the one that was nice, the one that they did a couple of years ago that Tony DeZuniga did.
Did you pick that up from Yancey Street?
Yeah. Yes, I did for the
Well, let me throw out a plug since the Rook's not here, and he probably would. Yancey Street Comics, which is a local comic shop in Pasco County, which is a great shop. You should definitely check them out, or at least check out their website, and we have a link on our blog to them. So it's Yancey Street Comics, and as Don would say, best comic book shop name ever.
Yeah, it's a really nice one.
Now, of course, I want to interject with the controversial question because, you know, I'm just the controversial kind of guy. What do you feel is more important in the comic book, the writing or the art? Is it the art that draws you or is the writing that draws you? Go for it.
Don?
Well, you know, it's something I was wanting to say. After we did those two shows talking about favorite comic book writer, I always said, and I still say, I read it because of the artwork. That's why I always bought it, and I feel like I gave the writers the shaft about it, because there were a lot of stories that I loved, and there was a lot of writers that I just think are the greatest. But I guess it's more like a movie soundtrack. You know, you always went to see the movie for the visuals and, you know, the story and everything else. The soundtrack, it could be a great soundtrack, but it was always there. It just propelled the story. You never, you know, if you saw a movie, you said, well, it's a nice soundtrack. That kind of defeats the purpose. The soundtrack is supposed to be there to propel the story, and you don't think about it. And I guess that's how I look at some of the writers. Now, I have read comic books that were drawn beautifully that really had crummy stories, but I still liked them. But there are certain stories that I remember quite well and loved and never gave the writers credit. So I think it's both important. But no, it's always been the artwork. It's just like Jan Stranod said back in 82, a good artwork can save a bad story.
Yep, definitely. What about you, Dallas?
Well, I guess the easy answer would be just the synergy between the two is what makes the book. But, well, my answer would be the writer. However, in the artist's defense... It's the artist doesn't only have the job of, you know, visualizing things on the page for people to see, but they pace the story. It's from the panel to panel, the art that they're creating. It really creates a dynamic flow, regardless of what the writer puts on that page. If the artist can't create art that flows with the next piece of art, then it's not really going to work. But that being said, I mean, writers can be very... Like Don said, it's like the soundtrack of a movie. I thought that was a really good analogy. They can kind of be background noise almost, just because they're pushing the story, but it's so integral. And I grew up reading like specific writers that had such a unique voice that you knew when you were reading a book by that specific writer. For instance, Chris Claremont, you know, as I have a huge love for that guy. So, I mean, for me, it's always been the writers. You know, even when I was young, I have to say, I've always been drawn in by specific writers. What about you, Al?
It was always the art, but then if the writing was good, it would be like, wow, this is like, you know, awesome. You know, because there's books that, you know, that you would get. I got to stop saying you know, by the way. But anyway,
you know.
Besides the point, you know. When I see a Kirby book that was written with Stan, it like really works for me. But some of the later stuff that he did, it's really good, but you know, the writing's not, yeah, you know, the maybe the dialogue isn't up to, you know, the task or whatever.
Well,
it was
missing something.
It was missing something, you know. So like you said, the synergy, those two guys, you know, it was a perfect match or whatever, you know. You know.
Well, that's what I've always liked was the team. It's what I explained. I like it. I do like it if one person does the artwork and the writing. In some cases, like Carl Barks, Gilbert Hernandez, Jaime Hernandez, you know, some of those.
Will Eisner.
He's another one.
Ding ding.
Yeah, but there are some of them where when you have a good team together, say like Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams and Dick Giordano, you couldn't beat it. I always liked it when they were together.
Oh, yeah. Mm. Oh, yeah. Well, Denny O'Neill was a good one. Even though sometimes I read those Green Lantern stories again, they were just like a little bit too...
Yeah, they don't hold up as well as I remember them sometimes.
Well, they were real strong in the 70s.
Here's a kind of interesting one, and just because I can go back to my old familiar analogies. Cerebus. Now, Dave Sim is the writer and artist on that. However, he's not only the writer, but he does the characters. That's it, as far as art. He doesn't do the background. So a Frenchman by the name of Gerhard does all the backgrounds. But that's a combination that the two of them together is more than the sum of their parts. It's, Gerhard adds so much dimension and flavor to what Dave Sim is saying that it really makes the two of them meld so well. Like you were saying, Don, there's certain writer and artist combos that just really work. Well, this works, even though Dave Sim draws the characters. Without those backgrounds, it's the world's just not as believable.
Right. But it was nice before Gerhard joined it. It was still a nice book. He just made it far better.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like I said, he made it more involved, more realistic. You actually believed in the characters and the world they lived in.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like, not in the sense where Gerhardt was really doing all the backgrounds, but whenever, like, Kirby would have different inkers, it would be kind of like, wow, this is interesting. You know, Vince Coletta's take on Kirby, yeah. Chick Stone, you know, it's kind of like almost like a different, you know, different view of the artwork. And it was always, with him, it was always good. Some artists, not so much. Oh, yeah. But, yeah.
Man, I'm just all giddy that we got some service talking there. I'm done. Well, guys,
you know, I had a chance to meet him, and he was doing an in store at a comic shop that I worked at. I never got around to do it. Bummer.
Well, before we go on, before we continue, why don't we take a music break? We have another local music spotlight. This is a chap by the name of Steve Robinson. He's originally from England. And he, Don, who did he play the guitar for?
Roger McGuinn.
That's right.
His band toured with Roger McGuinn in late 90s, or early 90s.
That's right. And this is a pretty close friend of Don, and Al and I know him as well. And this is one of his songs. So sit back and relax and check it out.
I lost my senses and found America. Tuned my guitar and waited for the call. I was just 21 and I knew everything. I turned 30 and forgot it all. Ooh, how the mighty have fallen. Slept through the good times, woke up the beast inside. And in between I kept the dream alive. We spit a line or two, I ate them up like you. Never been that hungry in my life. Ooh, how the mighty have fallen. Ooh, won't you listen who's talking.
I thought we only played bands that are no longer together.
Yeah, pretty much. He's the only one so far. We'll have to look into that in the future. Actually, if any listeners know of any local bands or any they're in a local band themselves and they want to promote themselves with all the listeners that we have, then contact us. Just leave us a note on the blog or email us. and you probably found us by our blog, but if you didn't, we're located at twodimensionpodcast.blogspot.com. The two is spelled out, T-W-O. And you can also friend us on Facebook. It's just Two Dimension Podcast. Okay, couple things real quick. I just got a text message from the Rook a little bit ago saying he's not going to be able to make it tonight. But before everybody, you know, gets all bummed, let me let you know, this is Labor Day weekend. We did have a lot going on. Rook took the family out. They have a huge barbecue. So I know he can't just run off and leave his family, unfortunately. Ellie and I went out. We were out with a few friends, a couple friends, and we went sailing today. And we actually just made it back in time. Actually, our friends are still over. Ellie's hanging out entertaining them right now. So we've had a few drinks. I'm actually currently drinking a nice, delicious Merlot and a Bud Light, which is a stupid combination, but that'll account for if I start to slur it a little bit. So that's that. But did you guys?
You kind of sound a little like Foster Brooks there for a second. That's like a reference to an old comedian. I don't know. There's a few who'll get that.
That's awesome. Well, okay. Well, so guys, do you have anything more to say, Don?
Well, you know, Al's first one was a team-up of Jack Kirby and Stan Lee, and I just thought I'd say something. I've bagged on Stan Lee all my life. I always disgusted me whenever they'd have something about the greatest cartoonist, and they'd always list him. You know, my whole life when I grew up, all the comic books had Stan Lee's name plastered all over it. It always had him gushing about himself and talking about how great he was, and it was almost like a carnival barker. And that used just to irritate me. And all the way from high school on up, whenever somebody found out I liked comics, they'd always say, oh, like Stan Lee? You know, he just became kind of a household name, even though people didn't know what it was.
But that was that was a lot of the carnival barking. That was the self-promotion, and that's how he got big, right?
Well, that's how I always took it, and especially when all the trouble with the creators' rights and stuff. That was something that bothered me, because he was always saying he created this, he created that. And it completely irritated me when, after Jack Kirby left, Jack Kirby continued to create character after character. And I never saw... Stan Lee created Nova. I remember they made a big deal that was the first thing he created after Spider-Man. Whereas Jack Kirby, I mean, you can't count how many characters he created for, you know, Marvel, DC, and several other companies. And so that was always my feeling about it. Even though Stan Lee's name was plastered over everything, I never bought a book because of him. And I just always looked at him, as a lot of people did, as somebody that stole. And then, as anything, you start learning a little bit more about it. It was when Roy Thomas, Dark Horse, put out those Barry Smith, Roy Thomas, Conan books, the reprints from the old Marvel stuff. And it started changing my opinion of it some. Roy Thomas was a big fan of the Robert E. Howard work, and he was trying to put the book together. And I guess they'd done 3 issues, and it wasn't selling well, and they were going to cancel it. And then Stan Lee saw how upset, you know, Roy Thomas was, and they said, we'll keep the book going, but Stan Lee was going to take a more active role into it. So the first thing he did was, for the 4th issue, Stan looked at the other issues, and it was always Conan fighting a giant spider, or Conan fighting, you know, it was always a giant monster or bug or something. And he said, this isn't going to work. And the 4th issue, they were going to have Conan fighting a giant lizard, which was in the comic itself. So Stan looked at some of the, you know, the rest of the story, and instead he changed it, and he just told Roy what they needed to put on it. And the 4th issue was the first Conan book I bought. It was Keepers of the Crypt, you know, or whatever. It had the 2 armored skeletons, and Conan and Jenna were there gathering up gold.
Was that Barry Smith?
It was a stack. Yeah, it was Barry Smith that drew it. But I bought that off the rack without even looking on the insides of it. And every time friends of mine would come over and I try to show them a comic I liked, they would always see that in the pile, ooh, and they grab it and read it every single time. Well, again, that was to me a strength of Stan Lee. He knew what people, you know, needed to see to sell a comic book. I've read Dan Adkins was talking about when Stan Lee hired him. He says, I'm not hiring you to trace. He was an inker. He says, I'm hiring you to embellish. He says, if you see something that needs to be added, if there's not a building there, you need to add a building. to me, that was it. Just what Al talked about was certain inkers could really bring certain elements out of any artist. And again, I attribute that to Stan Lee.
Oh yeah.
I was always seeing all kinds of things that he put together and pushed. I wish they would have talked about these things instead of the whole Carnival Barker thing about how great he was. He knew how to channel Jack Kirby's energy. You know, I'd read somewhere that they called Jack Kirby and Stan Lee as the architects of Marvel Comics, and that's absolutely right on the money. So, you know, I'll change my whole opinion on the whole thing. You know, Al was right. But it took me, 30 years to kind of get over this.
Well, he kind of, I don't know if you want to call it revolutionizing, but he really did, like, bring the comics, you know, into the 60s. You know, they weren't the, you know, the standard Superman, you know, books anymore. They were more like, you know, they had problems, they had issues, they kind of talked to you a little more. Maybe it was just Stan's soapbox or whatever, but it kind of like, they were more in your face, and I got to give him props for that, you know. And he had Jack Kirby, and he had Steve Ditko, and he had some of the great artists of the time, and they all worked well together for that, for those 10 years or 15 years or whatever, you know. 10 probably, because Kirby and Ditko were pretty much gone before this, by this early 70s or whatever.
But yeah,
I think Ditko left first.
He was a great marketer, you're absolutely right. I mean, he knew what the people wanted, what would sell, and that was one of his major strengths. Although the way he did that and the way he sold himself was the Carnival Barker image. Yeah, that's just how he got his name out there. And I think, like we were talking about earlier, I was asking about a specific writer, if he was really popular at the time, is because I think a lot of writers and artists maybe at that time weren't really well known, and it wasn't out because the collecting market and the fan base, they hadn't gotten to the point where they were communicating through fanzines and conventions, so they didn't know about a lot of these hot writers or artists, you know. But Stan Lee in particular, he was a hot writer and a hot personality because of the way he presented himself.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, it was like you said, he was kind of a Carnival Barker, but he was a Carnival Barker with talent, I think. And he had the talent to, like, you know, come up. I mean, he'd been working, what, since the 40s or whatever with Timely. He was, wasn't he, Martin Goodman's
nephew?
And he'd been there since, like, you know, doing the Atlas comics and all that stuff. So he knew his craft, and he just hit upon the idea of the pop art superheroes. And I mean, it's important. Those are important books for me anyway, you know. I mean, he created the Hulk, Spider-Man, co-created anyway, Spider-Man, the X-Men. I mean, those books are still... Yeah, every movie you go see now, it's either the Hulk, the Avengers, Spider-Man, you know, the whole, all those guys.
Yeah, I agree. Go ahead, Dom.
I was just going to throw in that the only thing you don't see in those movies is in the beginning it doesn't say Stanley Presents.
Yeah, it doesn't. Well, you know, he didn't even want to work in comics. He ended up, I guess his father pushed him to get a job, and he worked with Martin Goodman. But from what I understand, he wanted to be a prose writer. But, you know, he just, you know, he needed to be there. You know, Martin Goodman depended on him. And he fashioned himself into what he is. He was successful. And he did make Marvel what it was. I guess, you know, if you're towing the company line all the time and there's, you know, the creator's rights is coming up, you have to take a stance. And he was a company man. I just, again, a part of it just turned me. And that's why. In 74... they put out T-shirts with a drawing of him on it, and it said Excelsior underneath. And I thought, okay, come on, who's going to buy this, you know? And again, that just got to be, it was too much self-promotion for me all the time. But, you know, looking back on it and seeing, you know, finding out some of the other stuff he did, I certainly respect that, and I don't have the same animosity towards it.
Yeah, and when you read, like, Kirby's later works and Ditko's later works, they're good, but it's not really the same. I mean, Ditko went on that Ayn Rand objectivism kick that he's... and it's like, okay, well, that's cool. You know, A Shade the Changing Man and all that stuff, that's cool. But, you know, that early Spider-Man stuff, that's like the bomb, you
know? That's what
he's
known
for. That was going on in the old Spider-Man work. You know, if you ever read it, it starts out, he was kind of an unsure, twerpy kid. And it kept building up all the way to that one famous issue where there's that trap of Dr. Octopus where he's in the water.
Thanks, man.
And he kept pushing and pushing and finally beat the trap. And they say that Steve Ditko was basically, you know, following the whole objectinism. And at the end, Peter Parker came out on top. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he got mad and left. And, of course, when he did, that's when Stan Lee kind of turned it to Archie Comics of superheroes. It turned into the teen drama all the time.
But I love those, too.
Well, you know, not that they're bad. Those are great. But that was where it changed. But Steve Ditko was already developing that. But you're right. The team was great. And the Fantastic Four issues that Jack Kirby and Stan Lee did, I think those are still some of the greatest comics ever created. I bought the Omnibus, you know.
Now, is that the stuff that you grew up with, though? Like you started reading with?
Sure, yeah.
Well, it was a funny thing. As I said, I bought one of the issues when I was six. I'd never seen Marvel Comics before. A week later, they were showing the Hanna-Barbera cartoon. So that was my introduction. I never bought another issue till I was 12. This is 1974. This is when Rich Buckler was doing it. An older kid I had met one time, he had a stack, and most of them were Marvels. He had a lot of the Doctor Strange that Steve Ditko drew. He had mostly all the Fantastic Fours. I was always really shocked reading these of what went on, like... when they went bankrupt, you know, and then,
They went bankrupt?
Yeah. One of the old issues, the stocks crashed, and Reed Richards had all their stuff in the stocks.
Nice.
And I guess some of the patents and stuff he was selling, you know, just didn't make enough money. They ended up going to Hollywood to be in a movie, The Submariner bankrolled. He was trying to destroy them. But it sounds silly, but, you know... When you're 10 years old, 9 years old, or 10 years old reading this, you're like, what? How could they lose their money?
You're like, damn, this is really relevant.
Oh, it was unbelievable. But then there was another one. They went to the microworld, and they were going to become slaves. And they showed Sue having to basically slop hash to the lizard army. And, you know, they were made slaves. So how can this stuff happen? You know, and the way Jack Kirby drew it, she's... slopping hash, and her hair is just all over the place, you know, like she's haggard. It was things like that that was happening to comic. And, you know, like I said, I read all these in, you know, a couple of days. I was shocked at reading Sue had a baby. And, you know, he was turning into a little boy. And I thought, wow, I've never seen these kind of things. And then when I was 12, when Rich Buckler was drawing it, I picked one up. And by this time, Reed and Sue were separated. You know, she was with a Submariner, and they were fighting. Just staggering work. But, you know, so I guess you say that I kind of grew up on it away, but then it wasn't until later on that I started picking them up and reading them all the time.
Mm. Ellie just came in and asked if I wanted some more wine. She went and filled my glass. How awesome is that?
Well, what about the rest of us?
Well, yeah, really. All we got is we got Coca-Cola here. Maybe I put some rum in it or something.
Nice. Hold on. I'll ask her about that. I'll get her right on that, guys.
So what was your first comic book? I think we talked about it already, but refresh my memory. What was the first comic book that got you started? Or first comic book writer, I should say, that you like, wow, I really like this, Dallas.
Damn, I don't know. I know we did talk about this on the show. You weren't there, Al, so that's probably why you don't remember.
And I listened to it, but yeah. I'd like to hear it again, actually.
He doesn't listen to my parts, though. He just puts it on mute. He goes, oh, is that Dallas?
Yeah, I just
talking?
Listen to Don's or whatever. If not, he's going to hit me or something, you know.
I don't know. I mean, maybe it's like you guys. I can't zero in on the exact time I started or the very first book I had. There's a few first books that I really do remember latching onto, and they made a huge difference. And I don't want to be a broken record, but it was Claremont. It was those old X-Men's. I found... Uncanny number 97, which is an old Dave Cockrum Claremont book, in the quarter bin.
Wow.
25-cent bin. Pick that thing up.
Those are the days.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, that changed my perspective on a lot of stuff. It was a great book. Before that, I think it was like maybe G.I. Joe, Ninja Turtles, whatever was popular on the TV at the time.
But was it the art that grabbed you first?
Oh, no doubt it was. And I'm not contradicting what I said earlier, but yeah, when I first started reading, I mean, I was 7 years old, so it was the art that pulled me in.
Yeah.
And that was that Dave Cockrum stuff, and although I'm not a huge Dave Cockrum fan, that stuff was very colorful, and it was dynamic, and it was fun. I mean, he had some great character designs, and that really pulled me in. And that was one of the first books I remember actually caring about.
Oh, that's cool.
Oh, yeah.
When you said that about Dave Cockrum, we were both holding our throats, choking ourselves.
I know.
I love old Dave Cockrum.
Every time I say something bad about Dave Cockrum, I think Don's going to want to fight me. And I'm kind of scared because he's over a foot taller than me.
No, that's fun. Well, you know, it's something, this is discussed a lot on the internet and on other podcasts. When they talk about right now, I guess, is a writer's time. A lot of the writers, I guess you got Bendis, Loeb, Kirkman.
Grant Morrison's still big.
Yeah, but it's like they're writing stars, which is something, as we discussed before, I think Alan Moore was the first of the writers that got to be a big name. But they say now's the writer's time, and they always talk about the Image days when it was the artist's time. Actually, I never really read any of those Image books, so I couldn't tell you.
Lucky.
But... well, no, like I said, a lot of people love those books. But from what I understood, it was a writer art, you know, one person wrote and drew them, and it was concentrated on the artwork all the time. And now, it just seems like it's just the opposite, where I find it staggering to see the quality of artwork that's out now, how much of it. There's so many good artists, and the artwork, it just seems like there's a lot put into it. I don't read any of these books, per se, but... I'm just surprised at the amount of quality that's out there. But I'm always hearing about the writers all the time. People are following certain writers. So
maybe it's because the readership has gotten older.
That's a good point. That could be.
Well, I think...
and like, they're more into the writing more so than anything else.
Like any medium, I mean, the writers and the artists expound upon who came before. So in the writer's case, I mean, they have some really good influences. You have Alan Moore and Neil Gaiman, really good storytellers that can tell a long-standing story. And so, I mean, with current writers growing up with these books, they're only going to get better with it. And it's neat to see this evolution. It's the same with artists. I mean, you have a lot of, air quote, hot artists that are working on mainstream books, like Marvel, that... have, you know, a lot of background in previous artists, for instance, Bill Sienkiewicz, who had a very outrageous style, you know, who developed a very outrageous style in the 80s, and you have a lot of artists these days who are actually expounding upon that style, and it's really neat to see, but without artists as, like, Sienkiewicz, they never would have come about. So it's neat to see that evolution in the medium.
Oh, yeah. There are a lot of good artists, actually. I pick up a few books and I go, hey, you know, this is really good art and this is a real good story, but it's almost like they get buried somewhere in like there's so many books coming out that it's just like, and you know, they're kind of a little expensive, my opinion anyway, you know, so it's kind of like you can't read them all, you know, so you feel bad because it's like, wow, I'd like to get this book and
yeah, it's another show altogether right there, isn't it?
Yeah, well, yeah. Yeah.
Well, that is true, because there's been times where I've gone to the store and, you know, I don't have anything in my box, which is most of the time, so I kind of look around the store trying to find it. That's where I have found some of the books, like Thor, Mighty Avenger, I like so much, Iron Man, Enter the Mandarin. You know, I've never heard of these artists or writers, but I started picking them up, and I thought, well, these are actually quite good. But I remember those books were on the stands for a few months before I ever touched them. So, yeah, you do get buried. There is a lot of material there, and a lot of times I find it's just not material I'm interested in, no matter how good it is.
Yeah, the guy who did Thor Mighty Avenger, Chris Samnee, he's very good. He's kind of got that... it reminds you of Mazzucchelli a little bit.
Yeah.
He's doing like the Captain America and Bucky. I picked up a couple of issues of those, and those are very nice, yeah.
Now,
yeah,
Chris,
it's like Captain America 662 or 3 or something like that.
Yeah, Chris Samnee's a fairly hot artist these days, too. I mean, he's got a really cool style. I agree with you. He's very much like Mazzucchelli, at least old Mazzucchelli.
Yeah, before Rubber Blanket or whatever, which is cool. I like it. But yeah, the Batman Year One Mazzucchelli and all that.
Yeah, quite nice.
Absolutely. Well, as far as writers, I mean, does anyone want to add anything? Even Don, if you wanted to, you know, throw in another writer while we're on the topic of favorite writers, is there anyone that's really influenced you haven't brought up? I mean, I'm specifically thinking Walt Simonson, because I know you're a huge Simonson fan, and I was really surprised on the episode that we talked about writers that you didn't talk a lot about him.
Well, I wanted to. I mean, like I said, we all have long lists, and, you know, we covered a lot of different people. And, like, you know, I was talking about Gilbert Hernandez. I love his brother Jaime Hernandez just as much.
Now, those are the guys that did Love and Rockets from Fantagraphics. Like, it was a really popular indie comic. They were writer-artists, the both of them.
But Walt Simonson, yeah, I wanted to bring him up. I do like his writing just as much as I like his art. He's one of my tops. But, you know, we'd still be doing favorite writer shows if I mentioned everybody I loved. But, you know, bringing up Walt Simonson again, that work he did on Thor really threw me. Everybody talks about it, but that first issue he did, there were several elements. One was the cover. He had, you know, a monster on the cover wearing a Thor uniform, smashing the logo. And the whole logo and the little box with Thor on the side with the price, it all came to pieces. The next issue, it had, instead of Thor, it had the monster. It was Beta Ray Bill up there with a new Thor logo. And then the next issue after that, it had the two separate hammers, Beta Ray Bill's hammer and Thor's hammer on it, crossed. And a few issues later, you know, when Beta Ray Bill was gone, it had a new drawing of Thor. And it just amazed me, just with the covers, how he conveyed a story and the change. That first issue, just how he put it together. He had three different plot lines running in that first issue. Everything kept building and building and building for, I guess, 20, 30 issues, this whole giant epic. Everything kind of crossed paths and finished. When it was all done, the Rainbow Bridge was destroyed, Odin was gone, Asgardians were stuck in New York, and Thor turned into a frog. See how, in that case, the story was just as strong as the fantastic artwork that Simonson did. So he's absolutely one of my favorites. Going back, I mentioned Gardner Fox, but John Broome was another one. He wrote a lot of the Green Lantern stories. Robert Kaniger, he always wrote a bunch of stuff.
You
know, some of the ones Al mentioned that did the Doom Patrol.
Arnold Drake.
You know, it's a long list of people I enjoyed. I think back then the stories maybe weren't as complex, I guess, as they are now, but, you know, they told great stories in a few pages.
And I like stories that aren't complex.
I agree, too.
Simplicity is almost a lost art these days, you know? I mean, I like a story where you can just pick up a book, read it, and it's over.
Yeah, and if it's engaging, then it doesn't matter how complex it is.
No. It seems like, well, again, Marvel started this. Everything is, like, tied into something else these days, and it's just like, you know, come on, you guys, just give me one story. You know, I like the Spirit book that was DC was doing, like, and now it's been canceled. It had the new one anyway. They had, like, usually just one or two, you know, complete stories, and that's the kind of stuff I really like, you know. Yeah. I mean, I like to pick up a book, read it from beginning to an end, and just go, yeah, cool, you know. Mm. So,
well, as I said earlier, you know, I really liked the DC reprint books they put out in the 70s when I was a kid. They'd always find some of the best Superman stories, Aquaman stories. They'd always put like five of them, you know, in these 35-cent issues. And then later they put out the 100-page Super Spectaculars. That's the ones I always loved. It was rare to find Marvel comics, you know, in the neighborhoods I was at. You could see them once in a while. I'd pick them up, but what I didn't like was it was just part of a story. You know, it always continued, and that always irritated me really bad. Of course, you know, you got to remember, I was 9 years old. As I went through high school and college, that's the only way I wanted this story. I didn't want the one-shot issues anymore. I wanted these big, complex stories. So I think when now they keep talking about how long the story arcs are, I think it's because they're writing for 40- and 50-year-old men now. You know, it seems to me like in comics, for the most part, the kids are gone.
Yeah, unfortunately.
I don't see too many of them at the store that I go to.
Yeah, and I think that's why they're losing their main audience, is because they're writing for the people that have been reading for such a long time, which is a great thing, but they're not inviting in new readers.
No, they're killing their future audience, you know? I mean, but then again, their future audience is playing video games and, you know, doing things like that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. technology has increased so much that, I mean, comic books, the medium itself, is kind of left in the wayside because it's a paper medium, you know. A lot of people don't have to read. If you're going to watch TV, if you're going to watch a movie, you're going to play video games or computer games or even browse the internet, why wouldn't you do that instead of sitting back and reading a comic book? And it's really unfortunate, I think.
Well, they all disappeared from the, you know, general public. I mean, they're all in the little comic shops for the most part. I do know some people still like comic books, but it's rare to see them out anywhere.
So how do you guys feel, I'm sorry, about introducing, speaking of introducing new readers, how do you feel about the DC Universe's complete reset, starting everything over from number ones?
I think Justice League came out this week. I did not see it. I don't think it's that great of an idea, but I hope it does okay for them. You know, I've got no problem with it, but they are doing a lot of changes. And I just hope it's not done for sales reason. That would kind of suck.
Well, speaking from the perspective of a new reader, do you think that would be a good idea? I mean, it's kind of easier.
It might be a good place for a young kid to get into it.
Oh yeah, I mean, you've got these, you know, DC movies coming out now. You got Green Lantern. What if a bunch of kids are really excited about the Green Lantern from seeing the movie? I mean, sure, they were disappointed Ryan Reynolds was in it, but, you know, maybe they were like, this is a great movie, this is a great character, you know, where can I read about this guy? I think it's cool they can start from ground zero. They have that opportunity that maybe we had when we were younger, and to kind of grow with the universe, the comic book universe.
From the comic book perspective of the comic shop that we go to, Comics World, Pat, hey Pat, listen to our podcast.
There's a Comics link. World in Largo, Florida.
In Largo, Florida on East Bay.
There's a link on the blog, Don Comics World.
He says that he's actually told me that some people have actually canceled all of their subscriptions because they didn't like the fact that they're going to have to be buying 52 new issues, you know, and I was like, wow, that's pretty extreme, you know. But I think most people will end up checking it out, and
well, yeah, but
I hope it does good.
Are they honestly going to have to go buy 52 new books? I mean, how many books were they reading then of DC before that? If they were reading that many, then what's the difference?
That's what I asked Pat, because, you know, Pat's a friend of mine on Facebook, and when this whole thing came out, I saw John Suntress say he's excited about it. You know, see what they're going to do. Well, then Pat came on.
He's a pretty big personality on, like, podcasting, right? John Suntress?
Oh, yeah. He's got a really nice show that's worth listening called Word Balloon. You should turn our show off and download his and listen to that one.
No, don't do that.
And then go back to our show.
Yeah, and then come back to ours when you got time. But anyway, he mentioned that, and then later Pat came on. He was extremely upset. You also have to understand he's a retailer. And he was upset, one, that they were changing everything that he loved, and two, that, you know, it was the same day-and-date digital and print together, and he thought he'd be losing a lot of business that way. As time has gone on, I'd go in the store, and he'd start talking to new customers coming and asking about it, and he started getting more of an objective thing. I don't think he was really thrilled by it, but he was seeing some things that were interesting to him, and he would explain about, you know, different reasons why DC was doing this. But I had asked him at one point, I says, do you have anybody that bought everything DC put out right now? And he said he had one customer that got the entire output of DC in his box, and then when they did the reboot, he canceled it. Well, I always wondered about it. I've heard of guys that bought everything that came out. I know in the 80s there was some guy telling me that if you tried to buy everything that they put out comics now, it would cost you quite a bit of money. I guess in the 70s, 60s, and 70s.
I was hoping for a specific number.
I think he told me, but I didn't care.
Probably like about 30 or 40 a week.
Well, you know, I know in the 60s there were some people, I never knew them, but I'd read about them. They bought everything that Marvel, DC, Dell, Gold Key, you know, Archie.
I wish I could have.
You know how rich they are now.
Read them cover to cover. I've actually never had any interest to read everything that came out. I mean, I'd like to read a lot of it, but I've never, you know, everybody puts out stuff I don't really care to look at. But anyway, Pat said there was one customer and he canceled it. Well, okay. I read on the internet today that I guess the Justice League comic book that came out, I guess, set records electronically. People have been buying that like no tomorrow.
That's great news for us, though.
I think that's the Jim Lee book.
It is. Jeff Johns, I think, and Jim Lee.
Yeah, if you go to the Bee, which is on the sidebar of our blog, you know, they have a story about it. It's a brief one. But they did mention that it's up there.
You know, speaking of prolific writers, that writer, Jeff Johns, who I believe did JLA, he's huge in the DC Universe. He's taken characters and continuity that's 20, 30, 40 years old and really meshed them together in a very entertaining, streamlined way. And I gotta say, I gotta give the guy credit. I'm not a huge fan of a lot of those books, and a lot of it is only because I didn't grow up with them. But what I've read of his is very entertaining, and I don't feel like I have to be as engaged in the DCU as maybe people that have been reading for 20, 30 years. I don't need to know these characters to enjoy the book. However, I can see the payoff and the real value in people that have been reading the book for 20, 30 years, and they get these inside jokes and whatnot, you know? But, yeah, he's a really great writer, I think, and I think he's done a lot for the for DC.
You know, that's one thing you just brought up that I've never seen as an issue. I mean, I think every one of us, have you ever picked up a book or not picked up a book because you thought, well, there's so much that's gone on that I've never read?
Never.
I have.
Me neither. I mean, have you? Okay, yeah. Tell us which one.
Well, you know what it is now? And this is kind of a cop-out, but I used to read the old Chris Claremont X-Men. These days, I go to a comic shop, I'm not going to touch an X-Men book because there's so many damn titles out there, so much story going on. Maybe I'm the exception to the rule. I don't know.
No, well, I think there's times or maybe, but I've always picked up a comic book that I've never read. I mean, any of them, Spider-Man, Superman, you know, I'd pick them up. But the thing is, you start filling in the holes. You know, as you read the story, you'd find out, and sometimes you even go back and find older stories. I've never seen it where there's just so much stuff before it. Sometimes that was exciting, and I think a lot of times when you're just not interested in picking up an X-Men book, it's maybe you're just not really that interested in what they're doing.
I think you're right, and maybe it's the pessimist in me, so yeah, hopefully not a lot of people feel the way I do.
Because, you know, well, an example, Alan Davis. I picked up the X-Men once in a while when I found out Alan Davis would draw one of the projects. I like him. I'd pick it up and read it, and even though I didn't understand half the time what they were doing or where they were at, I still enjoyed the book, and, you know, I could piece everything together. Television shows. You may turn on the TV and watch a show you've never seen. You know, it could be on for years. But, you know, you can pick up enough of it right there to follow it. So, I don't know. I guess it's exciting to some people that they rebooted, and that could be fine. Again, Pat, he was really irritated at the beginning, but, you know, as time gone on, he gets more objective and talks about it, and sometimes I think he's interested in some of the titles that are coming out. I think you mentioned to me last week that you were interested in a couple of titles DC was putting out. Dallas?
Yeah, actually I was. I was just reading a list. There's a blogger that I follow on CBR, Comic Book Resources, that had mentioned a lot of the titles, and they sound interesting, and just being from Ground Zero, and me personally not knowing a lot about these characters and their backstory, it'd kind of be fun to just jump in and see what the future might hold, and how entertaining these characters really are. Yeah, so I might check out a couple, and if I do, I'll definitely let you guys know here on the podcast.
But, I mean, are they redoing Superman's origin for the first issue, or are they just going to continue and go like, hey, you know what's going on. Here's another story.
I really don't know. Pat's talked about this, but to me it never seemed like it was always definitive.
I don't know either. I really don't. And I think that's why maybe we should do a little research. Maybe each of us can pick up a book or two. That way we can talk about them.
The JLA came out, and I wanted a copy, but they didn't. They were sold out at Pat's.
Well, guys.
Well, like I said, on digital, it's been huge too.
I would like.
I can't see buying a digital comic though. You know, that's just like, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm there too.
You know, if I'm going to pay $3, I want something that I can like read. You know, in the living room, whatever. You know, I don't. I want it to be a tactile, something that I can see and read and touch. You know.
Yeah.
That's just me, though. Old school.
Well, I actually kind of think that the whole digital concept would be a really good discussion on an episode. But I think we're kind of nearing the end here. So before we jump off, I would like to introduce the segment. Well, actually, it's a segment I introduced last episode, if you guys don't mind. It's called "What Are You Reading?" So
okay.
So
okay, I'll let you know, Dallas, and get ready because I'm going to mention Creepy again.
Okay, go ahead. Sorry, I just knocked off my headphones. But yeah, Al, mention Creepy.
Okay,
and
I got this really great book at Pat's Store the other day.
Comic
well.
World in Largo, Florida.
Yeah, once again.
Link on the blog.
Comics World in Largo.
Bing, bing.
It's called Creepy Presents Bernie Wrightson. Now, this is the work that he did for Creepy back in the 70s, and this is primo stuff. This is like this and the Swamp Thing are probably some of his best work. This is like 130 pages, hardcover, $20, Dark Horse, great stories, great art, 10. I give it a 10 for art and a 10 for stories. And it's got one of Don Mine's favorite story, Jennifer, on here, which is like totally messed up Bruce Jones story that writes and draws superbly.
That's one of the most horrifying comic book horror stories I've ever read. And when Al showed me the book and I saw that, I started getting sweaty and short of breath. It's, you know, this is Bernie Wrightson, and you know, some of the heights of his fantastic powers. And, you know, the story is right along with the
art.
It's
disturbing, man.
It is disturbing.
And any comic that can disturb you is all right in my book. And Don, man, this book that you're reading, I want this book, but I'll have to buy my own copy. So.
All right, I'm going to, my segment, I've got a copy. It's called Genius Isolated, The Life and Art of Alex Toth. There's been a lot of Alex Toth books out. They're always nice to look at. But this one, you could kill somebody if you hit them with it. It's a big hardcover. It's by Dean Mullaney and Bruce Canwell. And it's staggering. Just reading the text, it tells Alex's life story, and it explains a lot about what he was about, how his systems of thought, how he looked at things. You know, if you listen to some of the podcasts, they talk about Alex Toth, some of the professionals. He basically, the way they say, he saw the world in black and white. And the way he did his artwork is basically how he lived his life, and it got kind of tough to be around. But this one has old work. It's got some work that neither Al or myself have ever seen. It has some unpublished work, and it has the entire run of John Fury that he did for the military when he was in the Army. The book itself is fantastic, but then I found out that they have two more planned, which I'm going to get sight unseen when they come out. The last one is Genius Animated, and I'm guessing it's a lot of the model sheets of stuff he did for Hanna-Barbera. But this book is just staggering.
I agree. It's a 10 and a 10 also.
Yeah. All right. And then, before I jump in with what I'm reading, I kind of forgot to say at the beginning of the segment that we are now adding a grade, a story on a scale of 1 to 10 and an art on a scale of 1 to 10. Don, did you have any scales for that?
Just what Al said. It's a 10 and a 10.
Nice. Okay. Okay, well, my book, funny enough, is The Tomb of Dracula. It's by written by Marv Wolfman with art by Gene Colan. Now, it's not the older Tomb of Dracula that Al was talking about, but it was a 4-issue miniseries that came out in 1991, I believe. And I loved the artwork. It was beautiful. It was very fluid. Gene Colan's obviously a master. And the flow from panel to panel was amazing. The pacing is amazing for the writer and the artist, actually. Some of Marv Wolfman's better work, from what I've read of his at least, but I'm not a huge Marv Wolfman fan. I haven't followed a lot of his stuff besides his Teen Titan work in the early 80s. It really reminded me of like an 80s horror film, and I think that's kind of a product of its era. But it was really good. I was surprised. It's actually the first and only Tomb of Dracula stuff I've read, so I'd be interested in going back and reading some of the older stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But I liked it. Yeah. But I'd say, well, I'm a little harsher, I guess, than you guys on grading. But story wise, I'd give it a 5, and the art I would give it an 8.
Oh, okay,
it's good enough.
So yeah, it was pretty good.
The original Tomb of Dracula, which you can get the essentials, even though they're black and white, but there's like 3 volumes with every Dracula story. Man, that art kicks ass, and the story is excellent as well.
You're going to have to loan me some of that stuff.
I will.
I never read those. I remember seeing them all the time. They were advertised. I'd see other people reading them. It was a really popular strip. And I remember they had a giant size tomb of Dracula and Spider-Man, I guess, combined, which was awesome.
But nice combination.
I never read them. I will say that their choice of how they drew Dracula, I thought was kind of genius. He had a mustache. You know, he was...
You know what? I heard that Colin patterned him after his likeness after Jack Palance.
Oh, I could see that.
Because Jack Palance did a Dracula movie in the 70s, in the early 70s, and I think Gene Colan kind of patterned him, and I could see it too, yeah.
Well, you know, the thing is, usually when you think Dracula, and any time you see anybody draw Dracula, it's the whole Bela Lugosi, which is nice. But I was really surprised at the choice they did, but when you saw him, you saw Dracula.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, I mean, there was never a doubt. I was always kind of fascinated with that. But my cousins, other kids from, you know, school, it was an extremely popular comic, and you still hear people talk about it now. I never knew that they did one in the 90s.
Four-issue miniseries, right?
Yeah.
Al Williamson.
Just a four-issue.
Al Williamson inked it.
Yeah, that's right. Well, good memory.
It all goes back to EC.
It goes back to...
exactly.
That's where it starts from, you know, yeah.
All right, guys. Well, I think that's about it for this episode. So I just want to remind everybody to check out our blog, twodimensionpodcast.blogspot.com. Go ahead and leave a comment below all the show notes and all the artwork and let us know what you thought about the show, and we'll definitely get back to you. Or check us out on Facebook as well, Two Dimension Podcast, and leave some notes on there or friend us. We really appreciate it. In the meantime, take care of yourselves and read more comics.